Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Dr. Peter Bregan, and I have a guest of all guests today, second time. Before I tell you who he is, let me remind you, upcoming, I'll be at the South Carolina Adelarian Society meetings in Myrtle Beach. I'll be there September 28th, Saturday, September 28th. Google South Carolina Adelarian Society meetings, Myrtle Beach. Great place to go, and I'll have an extended presentation, considerably more than an hour. I'll also be doing an extended presentation. I think it's, in this case, about an hour and 20 minutes or so. I'll be even longer at Myrtle Beach. But also, these are great conferences. R.D. Lang in the 21st century. R.D. Lang in the 21st century at Wagner College, Staten Island. R.D. Lang in the 21st century. And again, Saturday, because that's when I like to talk, when I like to fly places. I go on Friday and noon Saturday. I come home on Sunday usually. And that'll be Saturday, October 26th, Staten Island, R.D. Lang in the 21st century. And by the way, don't forget that I'm always blogging on Huffington Post. I blog on naturalnews.com, official blogging. And don't forget all the stuff on YouTube. My guest reminds me that I have all kinds of stuff on YouTube, including my Simple Truth series. I think we've got four of them up. We have a fifth coming up. Then I'm going to be recording more of them. And they've had now over 40,000 viewers on our Simple Truths About Psychiatry series. Now, speaking of movies, Kevin, are you there to hear your intro?
I am, Doctor.
Okay. Well, here it comes. My guest, my friend, a wonderful man, great contributor to humanity is Kevin Miller, Kevin P. Miller. Kevin is a producer, he's a writer, he's a director, he's got all kinds of awards, films like Let Truth Be the Bias, The Promised Land. Well, what has this got to do with me? Well, he wrote the and directed and did everything for a marvelous, marvelous film called Generation RX. If you haven't seen it, go see it. Go find it on YouTube, Generation RX. One Academy Award-winning guy called it a powerful and often chilling eye-opener. It's just fabulous. It's the best we have in terms of looking at the psychiatric drugging of America's children, Generation RX. Now, according to what I've read, he's also been featured in the book The Dangerous Man. I have no idea what that's about, by Karen Sawyer. I hope Kevin will tell us about it. But Kevin's a friend. Kevin's a colleague. Kevin is a man of conscience, a man seeking meaning in life, a man who does worthwhile things. And he says he just wants to have a conversation with me today for an hour. Hello, Kevin.
Well, that's always a joy to have a conversation with you, Peter. And listen, if I can get even one third of your 40,000 subscribers on YouTube, I will be a very happy man and filmmaker today.
Well, those aren't subscribers. I don't know all these distinctions, but we've had 40,000 viewers of a series I'm doing called Simple Truths About Psychiatry. These are 8 to 12 minute discussions I give, very informal. I sit there and I talk to folks about biochemical imbalances. I talk to folks about how to help people who are hallucinating and deluded. I talk to folks about how to examine psychiatry and live a good life. So it's 40,000 viewers for that little series of mine. Does that sound good?
Yeah, that sounds excellent, especially in the context of what you're doing. I mean, it's just getting rolling now, I'm certain, and before long it'll be 10 times that. And that's one of the things that is invaluable about your books and your contribution to Generation RX. Thank you very kindly for your your very generous word, because, you know, it comes across in the film as not only are you someone who's eminently qualified to speak to this, but your humanity and what motivates you, the empathy in you, and largely as a result of some of what you've learned over the years and the lumps you've taken over the years, and you've always come back to the patient and the person, the individual that's struggling with these conditions, struggling to understand them, struggling to discern which way is the best way to treat these conditions when and if they arise. So it's always been my great honor to feature you. As a matter of fact, we should tell your listeners that when it came time for me to start producing Generation RX years ago, you were the very first interview that I requested, because I knew all too well many of the things on the other side of the story with conventional medicine and what the academics, quote-unquote, had been telling us about drugs and how to treat these conditions and what their methodology was. So I wanted to get the definitive professional, the individual with the most integrity in speaking to these issues, and interview him first, and that was you. So it was really my honor and pleasure to do so.
Thank you, Kevin. You're doing a new work, a follow-up on Generation RX, letters from Generation RX or something like that. Is the title official?
Yes, that's right. And I hadn't planned to produce another film in this area. I really wanted to produce Generation RX and just tell the other side of the story so that people could weigh the information in the film against, again, what they had been told for decades by academia and by the medical establishment and certainly the psychiatric establishment. And so I really just wanted to produce a film about that, and it had haunted me for a long time before I finally released Generation RX. But after the film was released, and you know this all too well from your work, I received about 1,500, 2,000 letters or so after the film was released, and they came from all over the world and from people from all walks of life, and they essentially said things like, oh, you, Generation RX told the story of my life, or, you know, I thought I was alone, this kind of thing. And, of course, mothers and fathers and sisters and brothers sharing really tragic, private, personal stories about what they encountered through a loved one when they went on these medications and tragedy occurred. So it was really the breadth and the emotion of and the volume of letters that I received after Generation RX that convinced me that, well, I have to tell more people stories. And let's start with some of the things that people brought up in writing to me so graciously.
Well, that's great. And I don't know if it's premature, but when you do your films, you look for funding, for help. Folks, I've never asked anybody to consider supporting my work financially, and I've never asked you to support anybody else's, but here's an exception. The work of Kevin Miller deserves support. The only way he's going to do it is if the folks help him out. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, that's very kind of you. Indeed, I've never asked for support publicly from anyone for any of the films that I've ever produced over the years. But we know that this is the era that we live in now. I mean, between YouTube and the glut of content that's being pushed out every single day, it's become more challenging for independent filmmakers, particularly independent filmmakers who are producing films that may run contrary to the conventional thinking. So the timing is great, actually, to be on your program. In a couple of weeks, we're launching an Indiegogo campaign. And there is no site up as we speak right now. But within the next couple of weeks, if people will jot down literally letters from GenerationRx.com, then they can go to that site or follow me, and they can contribute, whether it's $1 or $5 or $10 or $1,000. They can contribute if it's something they believe in, and certainly if they believed in Generation RX and know where I as an individual and as a filmmaker are coming from, then that would be lovely. And they, you know, again, Peter, if they forget that website or whatever, then all of my image, if you will, across all of these social media platforms, whether it's Twitter, whether it's Facebook, whether it's Tumblr or even Instagram, they're all under the moniker Kevin P. Miller, all run together, lowercase. And that's how I've always identified myself, because there's only like 10 million Kevin Millers in the world. So Kevin P. Miller at all those platforms, and they can keep in touch with when the campaign's going to start and how they can contribute. Thank you so very kindly.
Well, you know, film is so important. Your film is the best that there is in the area of psychiatric reform issues and empathy and caring about the children that are getting medicated, and it's a huge contribution. But film is becoming more and more where communication is taking place. Visual is becoming more and more important. How did you originally get interested in doing Generation RX? I can't remember. I'm sure I knew it one time or another.
Well, I mean, that's a really unusual story, because you mentioned in the description at the very outset that I had produced a film in 1993 called Let Truth Be the Bias, and that was narrated by the great James Earl Jones, who you might recall as this, as CNN, you know, that guy. And he's Darth Vader's voice and so many other things in Star Wars. So when that film was being produced by me, I did a bunch of research in the National Archives and other places. Tucked away in a weird place of the 1991 FDA town meeting, if you will, on Prozac, the public hearings on Prozac. And when I saw the footage on this videotape in the bowels of the National Archives in Washington, I must say it just took my breath away. And it wasn't appropriate at all for the film that I was working on at the time, but I you know, tucked it away, and I, it was something I didn't forget. Well, fast forward about 11 or 12 years later, Peter, and here I was filming something for another film in D.C., and I had some time to kill, so I found out there was an FDA meeting. I didn't know what the meeting was about or anything else, so I dragged my cameraman over there, and I said, hey, I'm going to do some work on my laptop back here. You go film guys on the panel and just get some shots for me. Maybe I can use it in a future film. So I'm typing away on my laptop diligently, and all of a sudden it just struck me from the content of the conversation that was going on, and again, I was paying no attention to it, that, wow, this is, where have I heard this before? I was completely experiencing deja vu. Turns out that I had wandered into the 2004 hearing on SSRIs. And I, you know, all of the people getting up and saying, oh, well, you know, my father stabbed my mother on Prozac, or Zoloft, my sister committed suicide on Zoloft, or all of the things that I had heard, it catapulted me back to those 1991 hearings 13 years later. And so at that point, I realized, like, oh, my God, I mean, the tragedy that I felt in 1993 watching the FDA Prozac hearings from 2 years prior all kicked back into place again. And here I was in 2004, 2005 saying, you know, this, nothing has changed. Not a damn thing has changed. And so at that point, I just made a commitment that somehow I was going to raise the money and produce the film that ultimately became Generation RX.
Did we meet that day?
No, we did not. You and I did not meet personally until I visited you. I believe it was probably 2007 or very late 2006 when I came to Ithaca and first interviewed you. I obviously sought you out, as I said at the beginning of the program, because I knew that you had the most integrity. I had read some of your books, and I knew that you were a huge believer in not only revealing the truth to people, but in practicing empathy, and for the people who are actual victims of these drugs and of these conditions. And so that's why I sought you out. So I filmed some of that hearing, and that just made me committed that, wow, you know, here it is, 13 years has passed. And so I actually still had some of that footage remaining. And as you know, I used it hopefully wisely in Generation RX, all those wonderful, tragic stories of people standing before their government, begging them to listen to their stories about the side effects, the adverse events that so deeply touched their lives.
You know, it's amazing to think about that we had the 1991 hearings, and then it goes to 2004, and it's the same stories all over again about the same drugs, except now we got many more of the drugs, not just Prozac, and it's just astonishing to think about how hard it has been to get the government to pay any attention at all, and how the drug companies never really changed their tune at all.
No.
God,
no,
human nature and society, it's just sort of, you put it in front of my face like it was a film just now.
Well, you know, Peter, you said it perfectly, because it wasn't only the fact that I was experiencing deja vu and hearing these tragic stories from people. I was also experiencing deja vu while listening to the Dr. Thomas Loughran's and the of the FDA and those people of the world who were reciting the very same nonsense all over again. And I think that in part the only reason why a warning label was even ascribed to SSRIs at that point for, quote, children and young adults prior to the age of 23 is because of the work of people like you and the work of pediatricians who actually testified at that hearing, who had been moved by the testimonials of millions of people and the work of people like Dr. Peter Breggin. And they stood up and said, you know, you, at the very least, you've got to insulate children from this and find a way to put a warning label on this. And so, yeah, you know, every time we think that, I mean, in your case, you've been doing this now for 35, 40 years, Peter, and fighting the machine, if you will. And I must imagine that you're like me. On certain occasions, you get a little bit down about the fact of the pace of change. But, you know, the reality is that people are waking up and people are listening. And the person on the other end of this microphone here is somebody that really has had a huge effect. And I think so many people are grateful because you've had no agenda other than to try to save people's lives. And it's an agenda I share. And I should say to people that who are listening, one of the things I'm really most grateful about in regard to what I've learned about you as a man and as a practitioner is that, you know, I'm not a clone of so many people who are, quote, anti-psychiatry. And I want to be able to entertain intellectual conversations and even science-based conversations. So I so appreciate the fact that you, in all of your prominence that you held in this field, that you'd allow this outsider, if you will, this filmmaker, this researcher, this writer, to explore ways that, you know, that I feel are possible ways to help heal our populace who are suffering. And never once have you been threatened by that. Never once have you ever told me, Kevin, you shouldn't say that or you can't say that, even though we might disagree on topics. You know that my commitment is the same as yours, and I know that your commitment is the same as mine. And so, you know, that's something really lost in our country, is being able to have two individuals who respect one another, even if they don't agree on every single point, respect one another and honor one another. And I'm convinced that that's 90% of the reasons for your success over the years, my friend.
Well, thank you for that. I certainly respect enormously what you're doing. And I do remember, when you spoke last, I invited you to speak at our conference. By the way, folks, we're just not holding one this year. That's why I'm announcing the other places I'm speaking as they come along, because we're not holding a conference this year. The next one we have planned is, I think, 2015 in Michigan. I'll tell you about that a year from now. But I remember when you were speaking that we didn't agree on everything, and I can't even remember what we didn't agree on. But that's what I remember. We didn't agree on everything. I have no idea what it was. I think part of it was
political. Well, I remember, but again, it wasn't about that. And I think even during that talk that I gave, which was obviously some of the world's finest practitioners who came to your conference, who were sitting in the audience, so I was very keenly aware of that. And I was talking about some new and established research about micronutrients and other things being used as opposed to, quote, you know, the chemicals all the time. And my one of my main points was, well, good Lord, I mean, taking vitamins and certainly a heavy mineral-based thing is certainly not going to hurt you. So if people, you know, this research that's being done. But I remember announcing it to people and going through some of the stories, and I say, I'm not here to, quote, push anything. The idea is that we should be able to have a conversation about this, and I'm grateful to Dr. Breggin for allowing me to speak at your conference to so many esteemed professionals, just to be able to know that we need to work together. We need to stop infighting. We need to pull behind the ethic that you've demonstrated for decades, Peter, and, you know, really start working towards what's best for the patient. And one size doesn't always fit all, so let's find the way that, as Hippocrates so famously said, we can first do no harm and then move forward together arm in arm from there. And so, again, giving me that platform as a filmmaker, I'm a common citizen, to speak to these practitioners is just something I'll never forget and deeply indebted to you for.
Well, that's lovely. You know, I didn't know that, in fact, that it actually meant that much to you. I didn't know we'd be talking about this today. And I am so much in agreement with you. Recently, I've been speaking at, a month or so ago, I spoke to 200 chiropractors from Maximize Living.
You mean Dr. Ben Lerner and those guys?
You know,
I actually spoke to them a couple of years ago after the film came out.
Yeah, Ben is a great man, great guy. I love Ben Lerner. I just met him there. And again, there's a real common ground of wanting to do no harm and wanting to figure out how to help people with their general health. That's so funny that you know him and know him by name. And then I've spoken at some nutritional conferences, and I don't always agree with everything that's going on. I don't particularly bother to disagree because I think that the effort's there and people are trying to figure out ways to help other people. I just think we need a very broad base of alternatives to biological psychiatry. I'm fond of saying that the contest is not between biological psychiatry and anybody's therapy, certainly not biological psychiatry and Peter Bregan's way of doing therapy. The contest is between biological psychiatry and life. All that life has to offer, and that so much of biological psychiatry is just flat-out anti-life, the diagnosing people, the drugging people, the shocking people, and still even the lobotomizing people. Some of that goes on at Harvard and probably at Brown University.
Amazing.
And we just have to just have an open dialogue, a international dialogue about the spiritual, psychological, and the good health approaches to giving, you know, offering people opportunities to grow.
Well, I think the people are rallying around your common sense approach. And number one, I mean, unless you're completely a cold and unfeeling individual, how could you not be in support of things that you've written and spoken so eloquently about in terms of the empathic approach? I mean, who in God's world could turn that notion down? So I think it is, I think people are becoming more centered on how do we execute that empathy. I mean, we wish that there were 3 million Peter Bregans as therapists who could actually treat and counsel people who are troubled and who are in need of your expertise. Unfortunately, we're not near that. So your books and your videos and now, as you say, some of these alternative approaches are really opening vistas for families. And I just returned from Canada not too long ago, Peter, and I interviewed a number of people who had been literally taking this micronutrient approach. And there's a great lady up there who's been catching a lot of heat, named Dr. Bonnie Kaplan. She's a researcher, and she has been studying this micronutrient approach along with some other people. And so I interviewed about 30, 40 people who had been on these SSRIs and other meds, oftentimes antipsychotics as well, extremely violent individuals, extremely violent. At the drop of a pin, they would turn on you and cut you. And so there's encouraging work in there. And as you say, I mean, they're now looking at, well, what's the nutritional aspect? Is there a role for nutrition to play? And as you know, now there's been a lot of research that's been coming out over the last year or two saying that there's a connection between the gut and the brain. And so all of these things certainly deserve to be explored at the very least, especially when one considers how many hundreds of millions of dollars are being invested into the research behind the petrochemical and, as you say, the biological model of the brain, which is a failed model and is harming people by the thousands every single hour on this earth.
You know, the issue that there are just not enough, you said Peter Bregan type therapists. There are, I think, tens of thousands of good therapists out there. They need to be liberated from their fear of psychiatry. They need to be liberated to believe in themselves as healthcare providers who in themselves have the ability to heal without referring people for psychiatric drugs. And so a big part of what I'm trying to do right now when I speak is to empower the nutritionists, empower the chiropractors, and really, really help them believe in their own abilities to heal. And it's funny that Ben Lerner came up because, we're talking about potential plans for teaching in a very broad and general way empathic relationship, empathic therapy, not a specific one-person style, but just an approach to caring, empowering style of helping people. and teaching it to folks who may or may not have advanced degrees or may have unusual degrees. And I'm trying to work with a couple of different groups and hoping that I can get off the ground the idea that being a good therapist starts with being a good person, not in having a good degree, and that we should be able to train a lot of people on that basis to be very helpful human beings without their having even master's or PhD, but rather they're having an exposure to supervision and training in a caring, empowering, helpful approach to other people. And I'm just looking here and there for ways to do that through various groups and organizations. I'm hoping I might be able to do something with Ben Lerner's group.
Well, I think that's the logical next step, and I'm thrilled to hear you say that. I'd love you to meet Dr. Bonnie Kaplan at some point and some others. And there are certainly groups that I'm going to introduce you to who already know about you, but you probably never met, because this is the key. And as you say, it is the training aspect. And I think that when you look at, for example, how things have shifted so dramatically, let's say since World War II, Peter, and you know, when they came home, when the soldiers had shell shock, what did they do? I mean, they didn't put the vast majority of these people on drugs. They sat down and spoke with them about their experiences. They had empathy for them. And that was the model back then, certainly more than now. I mean, 90% talk, maybe 95% talk and empathy and 5% drugs. And now, of course, that paradigm's been turned on its head, and now it's the other way around. It's 5%
yeah.
talk and 95% drugs. And so,
listen, Kevin, I've been enjoying talking to you so much, I've run over the usual break time. So we'll go to music. I'm enormously enjoying talking with Kevin P. Miller, the filmmaker of Generation RX, the best film out there on psychiatric drugs. And we'll come back in a few minutes and continue our conversation. And this is Dr. Peter Bregan with my music in the background, Vangelis. My guest, Kevin P. Miller, filmmaker, really just a wonderful man. Generation RX, you can get it on the web. You can get it on YouTube. What's the easiest way for people to obtain it, Kevin?
Well, there are lots of ways. I mean, it's on demand on Amazon. People could go and rent it, if you will, online for a week for, I think it's only $1.99. Amazon on demand. They can buy it on Amazon. It's on Netflix. It's on Netflix in Canada. It's really all over the place. You can buy it on eBay even. So, I mean, Generation RX and YouTube. There is a pay-per-view platform on YouTube, and most of them are all very inexpensive because they want people to access them. So we've tried to keep the cost low and make it possible for people to see it relatively easily.
That would be an amazing $1.99, folks. That really would be, to watch Generation RX. Kevin, we've been sort of talking like old buddies here, but I also would like to just to kind of give you more of a platform to talk about life and what you've learned. And, you know, you've been a filmmaker dealing with unusual and extraordinary issues along the way, and journalist and so on. I just want to unleash you a little bit to talk to us about your life experience. I didn't prepare you for this, but is that all right?
No, absolutely. I guess the thing that I say to people first is that, you know, I'm a single dad first, above all else in my life, and been blessed to have my two sons who are now 21 and 23 on the other end of the scale. I've been divorced 20 years, so I really have, they've been the center of my life, and everything has come around that. But even before they were born, or as they were being born, there were all kinds of ethical choices that I needed to make on, in terms of my profession. And one of the films that people can go online and see for free right now is called The Promised Land. And it's the first film I ever did for television. It's a 23-minute film, Peter, about the homeless. And it was produced in 1991. And the first segment is about homeless war vets, because it's right after the, you know, the first Gulf War. And so it's broken up into a little seven. It was on a commercial television station. And so it's broken up into little 7-8 minute segments and are all put together. And that's online for free. You just put in The Promised Land, Kevin P. Miller, and it'll take you right to a link and you could watch that. And oddly enough that you're bringing this up, I watched it last night with a friend of mine who had never seen it and asked to see it. And so it's sort of fresh in my memory. And again, I was dealing with these issues. I was dealing with the idea of, well, how can it be that we send men and women to war and then they come home, or there's 180,000 homeless war veterans? How can it be in this country that is the wealthiest in the world that we're making these kinds of choices? And so The Promised Land was the first TV program that I produced that actually won an International Film Award. It came in third place behind, I think, CNN and BBC and, you know, other international news outlets, and actually came in third place out of thousands of entries. And so it put me on the road, on the path to say, you know, this humanism, this idea of focusing on people, it really works. And so I thought at that point perhaps that I was going to get on a track that would lead to kinds of, you know, a public television kind of work as a filmmaker, and that didn't materialize. But I've always been a person who's gravitated towards people. I'm a lot like you in that way, Peter. I'm always been fascinated by people, and in my case, I've always wanted to write about real people. And so, you know, when you produce a film about the homeless and you sleep with them under bridges for 3-4 days in 6-degree weather right off to the banks of Lake Erie in Cleveland, Ohio, for again 3, 4, 5 nights, and you're filming, you do feel not only the empathy that you're famous for, but you also see, you know, through them, this materialization of the fact that, boy, a lot of us are one paycheck away from poverty, and maybe 2 paychecks or 3 paychecks away from homelessness. And so I've tried to approach my life in that way, with that humility and understanding that a sea change can happen at any point. And, you know, again, to tie it back into what you and I work together on in the context of our talks about psychiatry, I mean, isn't that the truth? Isn't just one event, one simple decision, like the one made by Nathy Milling Downing to allow her daughter to be given a low dose of Zoloft? And, you know, as we tell in Generation RX, of course, an hour after sitting on her daddy's lap at the age of 11, watching Animal Planet on TV, she went to their garage and hung herself as a result of the side effects of that drug. So that's a sea change in Nathy's life now, of course, and you know her very well, and as do I, and we know what an activist and what a wonderful voice she's become, because that one decision changed her life forever. So I've really tried to keep that in mind, Peter, as a person and certainly as a writer and filmmaker over the years.
You know, it's so similar to my experience, you know, when I first walked on the wards of the state mental hospital when I was 18, which is not unlike many ways a homeless experience, because these are homeless people. That's mainly who would end up in state mental hospitals, and you got no place else to go. They throw you out of wherever else you've been. So it's either streets or the insane asylum, so to speak. And And I just remember thinking, well, you know, there but for the grace of God go I could. I'm 18. I could be that former Radcliffe student lying in the corner of that ward in that stinking, awful place and being completely out of her mind. It didn't take some huge stretch to imagine some blow or trauma or accident of fate resulting in my being as bad off as anybody else. And I think that's what you're saying in other words, obviously, but very close words, that that kind of sense of connection somehow was in us and has governed a lot of what we've done since then.
That's
and I think
for
it makes
sure.
for a good life. You know, I don't think it makes for a life of suffering. I mean, if you live by those principles, it makes for a good life. Wouldn't you agree?
No, I agree 100%. And I'm so glad that you used the choice of words that you did, because I've actually written about this, and there but for the grace of God go I. I mean, you know, Peter, I'll tell you, I am not ashamed to say that I am not a wealthy man, and that there has been a price exacted for my commitment. And yet, I live life in gratitude, because I know how much better I have it than the vast majority of our fellow human beings on the planet. And when you parallel it to your story, well, you were the cream of the crop. You were the top dog. You could have gone and called your shot anywhere in the world. You could have taken untold millions, if not tens of millions of dollars, just because you were that good and people knew coming out of university that you were that good. And so there, well, and you've paid quite a price for your own personal commitment. And one day I pray that I get to produce a film about your life, which would be a joy and an honor for me. But this is what's important. It is, if nothing else, by our actions, what I've shown my own children. But, you know, there have been days when the cupboard's been bare. And there's been days when it was hard to make all, you know, make the rent payment, so to speak. And yet, as you say, it is what makes life worth living, to know that I can stand here and say that the choices that I made were the right choices, the most ethical choices, and I could have compromised my talent any number of times and taken millions of dollars to go in a completely different direction. As a matter of fact, funny, I haven't thought about this in years, but we keep talking about the 1993 film Let Truth Be the Bias. After that came out, a company in Chicago, a production company, approached me, and they had a bunch of programming on Lifetime cable TV at the time, which was a big network back then. And they offered me all of this money to join their team. They wanted me to produce TV for them and be this big producer and director and writer for them. So like I am, I started investigating. I was like, wow, this came out of left field. What the heck? And I was newly married and had a brand new young son and all the rest, needed money badly. And found out that one of the principals in this company, his wife, was on the local board for the American Medical Association. And my film, Let Truth Be the Bias, by the way, was about medical freedom of choice. And so I found out that there were two people on this company's, you know, related to this company's board who were on the AMA in Chicago. And they kept upping the offer. When I kept turning it down, they offered me $65,000 and I'd have to move to Chicago. And then they offered me $75,000. And before you know it, Peter, it got up to $125,000. Not bad money for a young guy back in 1993. And I turned it down and found out that they, later on, that they had been trying to basically take me off the market, if you will. would be almost like if somebody came and paid you $1 million back at, you know, when you started, just to become part of a practice, to, because they didn't want Bregan out there talking truth to people. And so those are the choices that we're offered in life. And I'm so very grateful, and people listening should be so very grateful that you made the choices and that you've taken the hits for an awful lot of wonderful things that you've done for people quite selflessly. And that's not something I'll ever take for granted about you or people who make similar choices.
It's funny that you mentioned $1 million. I've never talked about this publicly before, but you inspire me to take a little bit of an extra step. But very early in my work, in the 1970s, when I was pretty much bankrupt, I actually at one point almost had to go bankrupt when I was fighting lobotomy. You know, I, the international campaign I did for 3, 4, 5 years, it was very protracted. I ended up so preoccupied with it, I'd let my practice go down, and I was just doing reform work, and nobody was paying me. My personal attorney at the time came up to me, and he said, "Peter, I can't tell you anything more about this, but would you give all this up for $1 million? And I said, "Well, what do you mean?" He said, "Well, I'm just asking you. You know, if there was $1 million, would you give all this up?" And then he wouldn't tell me anymore. And I said, "No, no, of course not. Of course not." He said, "Well, I thought that's the answer I would get from you." So God knows who would come to him. We had several psychologists have a very similar experience to you at the organization I founded, the International Center for the Study of Psychology and Psychiatry. Now we've moved on to a new organization. But several of the psychologists who started to write about things, two of them specifically, not several, two of them, told me that they had been contacted by drug companies and offered six-figure jobs in which they could do research in any area they wanted other than the psychiatric drugs. And the two people that I knew turned down the offers. Who knows who else didn't? And I've just lost track of them. This really does happen out there, folks. I've been blessed, Kevin, in that, you know, I had very little money for a very long time, and I literally was pretty poor for a long time because all the money I would make from seeing patients would be going into the reform work and supporting my kids and so on. But I've been very fortunate with the legal work that began to develop in the mid-1990s, really, which pays very well and gives me an honorable way of doing good as long as I select my cases carefully and also earning a living. And that's just been a bonus in the later years. I hope you get a bonus like that along the way.
Well, me too. But that bonus came from you to you as a result of your decades worth of karmic action, if you will. I mean,
but it's also just flat out good fortune or God's will or something, because there's a lot of folks out there who've done very, very good reform work and they just got killed. So it's a blessing.
Well, that's true, Peter. But you know, I mean, I've read your books, and I mean, I'm convinced that when you create, and hopefully this is what Generation RX did in a simpler way, when you create a document or a film with impeccable information, the drug companies know they cannot attack you or Generation RX over the science or over the facts that are included. And when they find that out, well, they've got to go 180 degrees the other direction. And so, you know, this is not solely just good fortune. I'm so pleased for you and Ginger, of course, that it did occur. But it also came as a result of people feeling what I felt when I read your books, and that is that you're really creating an impeccable case. that is not based on nonsense or hearsay or conspiracy theory or anything else. And that's something that I was wholly committed to. I was like, there is no way I don't want to be part of this conspiracy theory group, and you'll have to drag me kicking and screaming into it, because there's no need for it. All of the information's here. It's all legitimate. None of it's conjecture. And here are the facts. You make up your own mind. And that's what you've spent your life doing. And so it makes perfect sense to me. But it also makes sense to me that someone tried to take you off the market back in the early 1970s. And thank God you made the choices you have.
There are also scarier attempts, which I only allude to take me off the market more definitively.
Yeah, right.
Well, later
that,
on.
That'll come out in our film that we do, Peter. How about that?
All right. oh, golly, we've got just a few minutes left, maybe four or five, something in that range. This interview is has my head spinning slightly. Pick it up some more with just your own life, because I think it's really important. The choice you made, the choices I made, the choices you made, they have led to good lives. They were hard at the time and very scary at the time, I'm sure. But they lead to a good life.
Well, I mean, what I'm intonating is that I feel like I've had a good life even when, as you say, you're in the grip of poverty. I mean, even right now, I have a hard life if you look at it in the context of solely money, because people don't line up to give you hundreds of thousands of dollars to produce Generation RX or the next film, Letters from Generation RX. Peter, they simply don't. I'm ahead of the curve, like you were ahead of the curve for decades. So, but you know what? It's important. I say to people all the time, well, think about it. Okay, you're going through even financial challenges, let's say, and maybe, you know, you don't have all the new things that everybody else does, the new car, the clothes, whatever it is that you think you value. Well, what if you were to step off a curb, God forbid, tomorrow and get hit by a bus? I mean, no one could say about Kevin P. Miller or Peter Bregan that we didn't do exactly what we wanted to do in our lives. We were committed to it. We gave it all. We lived a good life. We were happy giving all of that of ourselves. And so that is my current condition. I'm not a Michael Moore. I don't have his money. I pray that I get that kind of money, not so that I'm personally opulent, but so that I could make more films. I could hire more people to help with the current films and do them in a bit more of a different fashion, I guess. And, you know, but it is a good life. It's always a good life when you're living a life filled with integrity, or at least even reaching for a life filled with integrity. So I'd encourage everyone to follow their bliss. It's not just Joseph Campbell or Buddha saying that. It's true. And I'm certainly living testimony to that. And I feel very blessed to be in the position I am. And you know, whether or not the financial riches come with it at some point, well, we shall see.
You know, it's interesting. I just want to mention that, you know, my wife Ginger, you know, whom you know, she has had that same view long before we met. You know, when she was a child, barely reaching teens, she took on the establishment of her local community over the abuse of animals in the animal shelter, turned it around, got to know the mayor, and you know, was on national radio while in high school.
Oh my goodness!
Because of her accomplishments in the area of standing up for what she believed in, and being teased shockingly by her classmates for caring so much about animals. Actually, the teasing being, of course, their jealousy of her courage. It's been a blessing. It's been just extraordinary for me when Ginger and I finally became partners to have a partner who lives by that same principle of doing what we believe in doing. It's funny, when you said do what you want to do, I know just what you mean, but it's not exactly how I experience it, nor I think Ginger. I mean, we do what we think we're supposed to do. We do what we think is right to do, and a lot of times it isn't what we want to do, but it turns out to be that it should have been what we wanted to do, and we're doing it. Something complicated like that.
No, I get that 100%. And, you know, I mean, I guess for me, I'm saying it's just more generally speaking, obviously,
yes,
as a filmmaker. I've been able to produce films. I that film I told you about, The Homeless, by the way, Peter, it aired in Cleveland alone. It raised $1 million for The Homeless in 1991.
Wow.
Then I went, and that was just in Cleveland. Then I went on and I made a film about race relations. And then, you know, so, I mean, I consider it this kind of blessing is that, you know, that in no way, shape, or form have I ever produced one thing that I was forced to produce. I just wouldn't put myself in that position. So, you know, this has led me to wonderful people like Dr. Peter Gregan, and hopefully we're together, we're making a difference in our own way in the world.
Well, it's a perfect way to end the beginning of more. Kevin will be back the next time he wants to be, which will be around the time that he's looking for funding and trying to publicize letters from Generation RX. Kevin P. Miller, proud you're my friend, glad to be working with you. The Dr. Peter Bregan Hour ends on a lovely note from Kevin Miller. Thank you, Kevin.
God bless you. Thank you.